Was Operation True Promise, launched by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards on Israel and condemned by the Canadian Prime Minister, a legal move? How are people in the region affected following several months of ongoing Israeli assaults? Did Iran's attack get the result it sought, or is Israel going to continue its efforts to threaten Iran? Will U.S. support for an Israeli counteroffensive expand the conflict into World War III? This week, we are now focused on what happens next, now that Iran has drawn a line in the sand, no longer tolerating further offenses against their citizenry, like the April 1st attack on their embassy in Damascus, and speaking to two expert guests who relay what they understand about what happened last weekend and what it potentially means for the region and for all humanity. In our first half hour, we have journalist, lawyer, and activist Dimitri Lascaris talking about the legal logistics of the various players of the war and about his most recent trip to the area. In our second half hour, former CIA analyst Larry Johnson offers his critique of the Iran attack, the consequences of an Israeli counter-retaliation, and the prospects of the U.S. intervening militarily on the Israeli side. Finally, we hear from groups across Canada about what they are doing in their efforts to confine the authority of the Israeli bull in a China shop. On this week's program, Israel versus Iran. If Israel wins the staring match, the earth may lose. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 19th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site Global Research. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The European settlers ended up with a bounty in the form of the resources of the land, taken away through theft, fraudulent promises, and broken treaties from the indigenous people who were here first and had a different relationship with it. Instead of continuing policies toward them of colonialism and genocide, descendants should remember where their assets came from and should seek going forward to pay reparations, including land back and earnest solidarity with their indigenous partners. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. The World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer estimates more than 35 million new cancer cases in 2050. This represents a 77% increase from the estimated 20 million cancer cases that occurred in 2022. WHO blamed the rising cancer rates on an aging population, along with tobacco, alcohol, obesity, and exposure to air pollution. WHO ignored the emergence of rapid-growing, quote-unquote, turbo cancers in people who have received one or more COVID-19 shots. Many of these cancers are showing up in young people, many under age 30, with no family history of cancer. Treatment protocols are available to help recover from post-jab injuries. That comes from the article, WHO Cancer Agency predicts 77% rise in cancers by 2050. Is the COVID vaccine causing turbo cancers? By Dr. Joseph Mercola, posted April 17th, originally published on the Mercola website. Science and free speech were among the earliest victims of COVID-19. Millions of papers came out, most of them of very poor quality, and authorities quickly forgot that they are obliged to base their decisions on the most reliable science. Torturing your data till they confess became acceptable. And if randomized trials did not confess to what the authorities wanted, they ignored them and based their decisions on flawed observational studies instead. The lockdowns went counter to what we knew about respiratory viruses, that it is impossible to lock them out, and they caused a lot of collateral damage, including an increase in deaths from other causes than COVID-19. That comes from the article, "In the wake of COVID panic and the lockdowns, the death and resurrection of science," by Professor Peter C. Goetsche, posted April 17th, originally published on Brownstone Institute. However, American military sources are complaining that too many countries have outright refused to allow the deployment of the, quote, Typhon, unquote, on their territory. Still, this doesn't seem to serve as a clear deterrent to the aggressive Pentagon planners, as they're also deploying similar weapons with other service branches, including the U.S. Marine Corps, or USMC, which also has land-based Tomahawk launchers, albeit on a completely different platform, the 4x4 Joint Light Tactical Vehicle, or JLTV. Worse yet, back in 2021, meaning before the SMO, Special Military Operation, the U.S. Army reactivated its 56th Artillery Command in Germany to oversee forward-deployed units equipped with Typhon and similar strike platforms such as the Dark Eagle hypersonic missile, which is yet to be delivered, as it's still going through a rather rocky development. Interestingly, the 56th Artillery Command had battalions equipped with Pershing and Pershing II nuclear-armed ballistic missiles during the first Cold War. In other words, the U.S.-led political West is antagonizing both multipolar superpowers, openly taking pride in the fact that it can get into their, quote, geopolitical backyards, unquote. That comes from the article, U.S. Moves Previously Banned Missiles Closer to China and Russia, by Drago Bosnick, posted April 17th, originally published on InfoBricks. However, I see April 2024 as a watershed moment. The turbo cancer papers are starting to come in now fast and furiously. More case reports, more hypotheses, more evidence of mRNA-induced turbo cancer in the population. Despite the best efforts of Big Pharma and their corrupt allies in politics, media, and medical associations, the truth about mRNA-induced turbo cancer cannot be suppressed or hidden. It's coming out, and there is no turning back. The dam is breaking, and it will take Pfizer and Moderna with it. That comes from the article, Turbo Cancer Literature is Growing Rapidly. The dam is breaking, and it will take Pfizer and Moderna with it, by Dr. William Mackus, posted April 17th, originally published on COVID Intel. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Dimitri Lascaris is a lawyer, a journalist, and an activist. From 2004 to 2016, he was a member of Canada's leading class action law firm, Siskins LLP. He now works pro bono legal cases. In 2020, he ran for the leadership of the Green Party of Canada and placed second with 45.5% of the membership. He recently visited the Middle East region and is in Greece at the moment. He's here to update us on what's happening in the ongoing Israel-Gaza fight. Good afternoon, or I guess it's more like a good evening where you are. Welcome to the show, Dimitri.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. Now, from our two previous conversations on the Israel war on Gaza, what they call the Israel-Hamas war, actually, I think the last one was in January, so that's already 3 months ago. I can't believe it. But you expressed trepidation about it spreading wider into the region and even including Iran. And sure to form, Iran has officially gotten involved with the attack of drones and ballistic missiles in Israel. The first attacks directly by Iran against Israel since, the dawn of the Iran-Israel proxy conflict going back nearly 40 years. No one was hurt except, I suppose, from an Israeli girl injured by some of the shrapnel or something like that. And Iran said, "Hit us again, and we will assault you even harder the next time." So with Israel going ahead, perhaps as soon as tonight with another attack, did you ever really anticipate the war would spread to this extent?
Oh, I think it's going to get much worse. In fact, it has been my belief from the outset, and I'm sad to say that my prediction has been vindicated thus far, that unless and until the Western backers of Israel put a stop to the genocide in Gaza, and there's one simple way to do that, and that's to cut off the flow of weapons from Western countries to Israel. It's all they have to do. If they weren't going to do that, and they haven't done that, and there's no indication that they're going to do that, that this would eventually engulf the entire region in a devastating war that would make the criminal invasion of Iraq by the US and Britain look mild by comparison, as horrific as it was. And we are now in a situation where the Iranians are saying very clearly, they're communicating in no uncertain terms that the rules of engagement have changed fundamentally, whereas previously they were prepared to play the long game and wait for whatever opportunities might present themselves in other areas of conflict in West Asia to retaliate. They are now going to attack Israel directly. This is what they're saying. And it's very important. It's being underreported in the media, the Western media. But at the United Nations, the emergency meeting after the attack on Israel, where they debated the legality of what Iran had done, the Iranian representative said repeatedly, any aggression, any provocation, any further attack on Iran will be met with a far more devastating attack on Israel. And just to drive home the point, the president, Raisi, said in no uncertain terms that we will no longer tolerate any aggression against our interests, whether it's in our country or outside our country. What this means, there should be no mistaking what they're communicating. Whether they're serious, I don't know, but I wouldn't assume they're bluffing. They're saying that even if Israel resorts to the kinds of attacks that it's engaged in the past, where it was killing Iranian military personnel in Syria, for example, not at a diplomatic mission, but for example, out in the field, in their homes, at their bases, and they're all there lawfully at the invitation of the internationally recognized government. Iran did not retaliate by attacking Israel. And I believe what they're telling Israel is that any attacks of that nature, you are now going to be met with a far more devastating drone and missile attack than the one you've already sustained. And so all of this talk that Israel is engaged in, they're talking, if you look at the Israeli press, and I've been following it closely, they're talking about some lesser retaliation than a direct attack on Iran itself. That's not going to avoid a conflagration based on what we're hearing from the Iranian government. Any form of retaliation is going to set the region on fire. That's what they're signaling, and I think it's unambiguous.
Well, the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, publicly condemned the attack by Iran in the strongest possible terms and launched a new round of sanctions against the Iranian regime. Opposition leader Pierre Poilievre also unequivocally condemned the attacks on Israel and demanded the Canadian government ban the Tehran-controlled Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, which he calls a terrorist group, from, quote, using our country to raise funds, planned and coordinate, unquote, and that his party stands with Israel. And even Jagmeet Singh, the leader of the NDP, said, quote, the IRGC is a terrorist organization and should be thus named, unquote. The Bloc Québécois said they would be voting for the Conservative MP's motion to have the IRGC listed as a terrorist organization. From a legal perspective, then, you know, are we talking about legal moves by Iran?
Well, Iran articulated a legal case at the United Nations Security Council. It has explicitly invoked Article 51 of the UN Charter. And it's left, you know, other countries, and particularly South Africa and Nicaragua, to pursue Israel and its backers. In the Nicaragua case, of course, it's Germany that's being pursued in international courts. But it is articulating a legal justification for what it did. And within hours of Trudeau unequivocally condemning, and Melanie Jolie said the same thing, of course, what Iran had done, a group of UN experts, independent experts appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council, issued a statement that Israel's attack on the diplomatic mission was a violation of international law. And effectively, they said it was an act of war. I've been saying this from day one, as have other legal experts. This is a flagrant violation of Article 22 of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which declares that diplomatic missions are inviolable. There's no evidence that Iran was about to use its diplomatic mission in Damascus to launch an attack, you know, from the premises of the building. Perhaps then Israel might have had an argument that it was justified in destroying the building, but there's absolutely no evidence of that, and it would be shocking.
Hold on a second. I mean, if the point I think that's missing is that Iran actually has proxies in the region, right? I mean, like Hamas and Hezbollah are known by Israel and the U.S. to get their training by Iran. I mean, they're proxies, they're puppets. I mean, I'm not saying that I support what Israel's doing, but I'm just saying that, you know, Iran's hands aren't exactly clean. And I mean, it's like they're like the mob boss, and they're not to blame when their underlings are doing all the work with their, you know, their terror attacks on Israel. So,
I thought we were talking about the legality of Israel's destruction.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about. Everything you've just said, it could be all true. It doesn't amount to a hill of beans from a legal perspective. Mm-hmm. That does not justify the destruction of the diplomatic mission. And this is the part about this argument that I find so preposterous. If you're going to take the position that Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism, applying to it the standard definition we use of terrorism in the West, which is, acts of violence targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure for a political objective, there's no worse terrorist actor in the Middle East than Israel, for God's sakes. They've just massacred over 14,000 children. They have massacred over 30,000 civilians. The vast majority of them are women and children. They're starving to death the population. They have literally flattened over 50% of Gaza. They've rendered it grotesquely unlivable. Every single day, they're murdering women and children with bombs, with Western munitions. And people are complaining about Iran. I mean, this is preposterous. All of the, let's assume that every single allegation that has been leveled against Iran and its proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, and so forth, is true. It still doesn't amount to a fraction of the violence that Israel and the United States have inflicted on the peoples of West Asia for the political objective of asserting their dominance over the region and controlling the resources of the region. And that is straight up terrorism. So let's get real here. You know, how dare they? How dare they say this is a terrorist organization as they are funneling arms to the worst state terrorist actor, perhaps on planet Earth, namely Israel? They're taking us for fools. And it's time for us to put our foot down and say the double standard must end, because this is going to result in a devastating war. The whole world outside of the West sees that this is a lie, that this is hypocrisy, the claim that we are upholders of a rules-based international order. They've had it with this. They've had it through and through. And by the way, whatever you may think about the terrorism argument, there's no question that Israel's committing a genocide and we're enabling it. And we're going to point the finger at Iran? Please. That's preposterous.
So you've completed another five-week journey to the region. Talk about the places you visited this time and what you learned on the ground about the situation.
So I started my journey in Qatar, where I attended a major weapons exhibition called DIMDEX as an observer. Then I went to Amman briefly, and I attended a pro-Palestinian protest outside the Grand Husseini Mosque. Then I traveled by land into occupied Palestine over the Allenby Bridge from Jordan. And I spent about 10 days mostly in the occupied West Bank in East Jerusalem. And I went to three refugee camps, I should say, in the West Bank that have been particularly hit hard by Israeli forces. Tul Karm, Jenin, and Farah refugee camps. Then I traveled to the edge of the border of Gaza, just outside the Israeli settlement of Sderot. I was about a kilometer away from Gaza, and I could see I was on a hill, and I spent an afternoon filming and witnessing what was happening there to the best of my ability based on where I was situated. Then I went down to the Red Sea port of Eilat, to see how the Israeli Red Sea port of Eilat, to see how the attacks of Ansar Allah on Red Sea shipping were affecting the port. Then I went to Lebanon and I stayed in Beirut, but I spent quite a bit of time in the Bekaa Valley and South Lebanon, where there was quite a bit of destruction inflicted by Israel on civilian infrastructure. And then I returned to Greece, where I am now. And I've been waiting to be given permission to enter Yemen. I don't know if I'll be granted that permission. I've been waiting quite some time. Another possibility is that I will go to Tehran, and that's where I will complete my mission.
Yeah, and did you notice like any changes in the attitude of the people, especially when in Lebanon, their attitudes may have changed in any way, or is it more resilient or more fearful or what?
Well, that was the third time I've been to Lebanon in the past year. The first time was in March, and the second time was right after October 7th. The country was already, when I went in March and before any of this began, it was reeling from an economic crisis. But the southern border was largely quiet. Then when I went in October, hostilities had begun, and there was a lot of concern, I think we can say, to put it mildly, amongst the population in Lebanon, including in the capital. I don't think anybody in Lebanon feels safe because A, it's a very small country, and B, Israel has both the capacity and the willingness to inflict massive damage in any part of Lebanon, as history has proven again and again. So when I went this most recent time, I think, yes, people are very fearful of a war. How people feel about using military methods to protect or try to help in some way the Palestinian people, it depends on who you talk to. Certainly the supporters of Hezbollah, and they constitute a substantial proportion of the population, are very supportive of what Hezbollah is doing. There are other groups. It's not simply the supporters of Hezbollah who feel. So, for example, some members of the Christian Arab community are also supportive of Hezbollah's efforts. But I don't think anybody has any illusions about how ugly this could get for Lebanon. They've been through this before. So far, as horrible as the damage is that they've sustained, they've sustained far more civilian casualties since October 7th than Israel has as a result of Hezbollah's attacks. It's a multiple of four or five. And the number of fighters that they've lost, Hezbollah is also a large multiple of those that Israel acknowledges having lost in Hezbollah attacks. So Israel is using disproportionate force against the Lebanese, and they understand where this could lead, and I think they're deeply concerned.
Okay, well, I just have one more piece of it's rather disturbing news to bring to your attention, Dmitry, and it's in the United States earlier today, the 17th, according to the press, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to condemn the chant, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," as hate speech. Okay, I'm serious. I mean, Congressman Josh Gottheimer stated, quote, "Our resolution makes it clear that the slogan, 'From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free,' is anti-Semitic and calls for the total eradication of the Jewish democratic state of Israel and the annihilation of the Jewish people," unquote. The slogan has bipartisan support. I don't know if something similar is being prepared for Canada, but it would brand a lot of peaceful rallies taking place every weekend as hateful and illegal. I mean, could I get you to comment on this latest attack on resistance at home?
Well, this is part of a larger trend of censorship in our society, and it didn't begin with the genocide in Gaza. It has been gathering speed, the impetus for censorship, for some years now. And this online harms legislation, which I just criticized at length, I've reviewed the entire legislation, and you can see the article on my website. I describe this as a severe threat to free speech. So it's not just about Palestinian rights, and people better be very concerned if they really care about their right to speak freely and maintaining what remains of democracy in our society. Whatever they may feel about the Palestinian issue, they should be very concerned about this sort of thing. As to the merits of the specific argument, first of all, I would point out that the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism, which was promulgated by and supported by over 200 scholars in anti-Semitism, a great many of them Jewish, specifically address this issue and say that calling for the Palestinian people to have equal rights from the river to the sea is not anti-Semitic at all. And, you know, the presumption, the unspoken assumption being made by those who argue that this is anti-Semitic or that it's some expression of a terrorist impulse is that, you know, those who use the phrase believe that the only way that the Palestinian people can be free from the river to the sea is for the Jewish population of Israel to be annihilated. That's their unspoken assumption. Anybody with an ounce of objectivity and a functioning brain should know that that's not true, that it's entirely possible for the Palestinian people to be free and live and coexist peacefully, either side by side in their own state or in one state with the Jewish population of Israel. It's entirely possible. And in fact, this is what happens in Canada and every other Western state. There are Palestinians and Jews in Canada and every other Western state coexisting peacefully. There's no reason why this can't happen in Israel. So the underlying assumption of the claim that this is hate speech or some kind of call for terrorism is patently and obviously false. At the end of the day, the best way for us to protect our right to speak freely is to continue to use the phrase and challenge this action in court to the extent that these types of resolutions are used against us to silence us.
Okay, so it's always a pleasure engaging you this way, Dimitri. And you're giving presentations across Canada in the not-too-distant future, right, in the cities across Canada?
Yes, I've been asked by Canadian peace groups to do a national speaking tour about my trip across West Asia, beginning in mid-May, and it'll run till early June. And I plan to visit, I'll go all the way to Vancouver and Victoria, maybe Edmonton, Winnipeg, Regina, Toronto, London, Ottawa, Hamilton, Montreal, and Halifax. So that'll be for a three-week period beginning in mid-May.
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing from you here in Winnipeg. So thanks a lot, Dimitri.
Thank you, Michael. Always a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Dimitri Lascaris, lawyer, journalist, and activist based in Montreal. He joins us this week from Greece. You can visit his website, dimitrilascaris.org.
Listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
The world watches on and anticipates what started as a counterattack by Israel against Hamas for its October 7th action against Israelis, now broadening into an even wider war. After Israel launched an attack on an Iranian embassy in Damascus on April 1st, they sent a response of hundreds of drones and ballistic missiles on Israel. This move was mostly countered, according to Israel and Western media, by Israel's Iron Dome protection with anti-missile defense courtesy of the U.S., U.K., France, and Jordan. The U.S. and G7 partners all condemned Iran's moves and launched a new round of sanctions that are urging Israel to not succumb to revenge attacks. Israel does not seem to be listening and are launching an attack of their own at a time of its own choosing, apparently. Iran said if it does, it will send another attack 10 times bigger. This does not sound like good news. Joining me to discuss this volatile situation and provide an expert opinion of where it is headed next, we are joined by Larry C. Johnson. Larry C. Johnson is a veteran of the CIA and the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. He's the founder and managing partner of Berg Associates, which was established in 1998. Larry provided training to the U.S. military's Special Operations Community for 24 years. Good morning, Mr. Johnson. Thank you for agreeing to be our guest on the Global Research News Hour.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you.
Now, we all knew about the attack coming by Iran because they announced it in advance. Give us a brief assessment of the attack on the weekend. It was spectacular and frightening, but Israel and its allies and the press said it was mostly unsuccessful due to their anti-missile defense capabilities, you know, taking out 99%. Did the attack achieve what Iran wanted, however?
Absolutely. The Western spin in this is just frankly ridiculous. And the people pushing that nonsense ought to be embarrassed. Number one, the fact that Iran pre-coordinated this, not just with Turkey, Oman, Jordan. I mean, it warned those countries, here's what we're going to do. But Pepe Escobar reported that, in fact, CIA Director Bill Burns sat down in Oman with an Iranian delegation or Iranian representative and got the same heads up. And Iran was making clear, say, look, we have been, our national sovereignty has been violated. An attack on any diplomatic facility is a violation of the Vienna Convention of 1961. And up until now, United States and all of Europe used to believe that any attack on any kind of diplomatic facility was absolutely wrong, criminal, act of war. But if it's Iran, never mind, no big deal. Which is just, it's ridiculous that that kind of hypocrisy is rampant in the West. So the West is saying, oh, yeah, this is no big deal. No, yeah. The fact that by Israel's own admission, they used up armaments worth over $1.3 billion in order to shoot down the incoming drones, cruise missiles, and they did not shoot down any of the ballistic missiles. Well, what Iran demonstrated is that it could launch a simultaneous attack using three different weapon systems, with the drones being used like pawns in a game of chess, put out front in order to be lost, in order to draw out the enemy, the opposition, which is exactly what it did. For every drone that Israel shot down, or that the U.S. Pilots did, or the British pilots, they had to use on average two missiles, for at least from the Iron Dome, two missiles per object that was they were going after, and those get to be pretty expensive. So the Iranian, that first wave sort of sucks in all of the air defense systems. The next wave of cruise missiles, which are traveling, they travel faster, so they were launched after the drones were launched. They come in and suck up some more, and then the ballistic missiles hit. And those were the ones that were targeted at the air bases and the intelligence center that Israel had used to plan the attack in Damascus on April 1st. So, but with all of that, what Iran demonstrated was, we can hit you, and you can't stop us. And there is actually video of one of the inbound Iranian warheads. It's maneuverable. It's literally, as it's coming down towards the ground, it suddenly takes a sharp 90-degree turn and then proceeds downward again. It's evading an interceptor missile that was trying to hit it. So this nonsense that this is a massive victory for Israel, what I think all of that is spin to try to convince Israel not to retaliate against Iran.
Well, okay, according to a statement on Iran, the president's website, and Al Jazeera, President Raisi warned that if Israel launched the tiniest attack against Iran, the reaction from Iran would be swift. And this is a quote, "That is the time when the supporters of the Zionist regime will find out that their hidden power will not be able to do anything," unquote. There could be a full-fledged war by the time this interview makes it to air and in 2 days' time. If that happens, what's next? I mean, setting aside the battles on the fronts of Gaza and Lebanon, does Israel have any advantages over Iran that could be used to their advantage?
No, it really doesn't. The people already say, oh, they have nukes. Okay, they're going to go ahead and use a tactical nuke. They don't have enough nukes to cover Iran. Iran is a huge country. I think it's like rated as the sixth largest country in the world. But it's as significant in size.
Well, there are several nukes, aren't there? I mean, it's not just...
Yeah, but it's what I'm talking about. Even so, Israel's ability to launch all those nukes and to get them all through the air defense system that Iran has is really up in question. But Iran is allied militarily with Russia and China. Russia and China are not going to stand by and let Israel go out and just launch nukes at whoever the hell it wants to. And that's why I said Israel has a lot more to lose in this against going after Iran. And they ignore the fact that even if they launch nukes, Iran has probably 10,000 missiles, ballistic missiles that it can launch on Israel that carry, even with conventional warheads, will just completely devastate Israel. Right now, what the Iranians did the other day was they said, look, we're only going to go after military facilities. We're not going to target any diplomatic facilities. We're not going to target civilians. Depending upon the target that Israel hits inside Iran, if that's what it is determined to do, will decide how Iran responds. And Raisi he's not lying. He's not exaggerating. He's not, you know, trash-talking like, you know, Conor McGregor before a UFC or, you know, Ultimate Fighting Championship battle. He's being very direct about the seriousness that Iran is approaching this issue. And the West ought to take heed.
Well, on the positive side, I mean, Israel, at the beginning of this action in Gaza, it was thought to be going after Gaza's resources. I mean, they were forcing the people off the land and were taking it over. At the conference for Israel's victory at Jerusalem's International Convention Center in January, 11 Israeli cabinet ministers and 15 members of the coalition were actually dancing around the hall, singing celebratory songs and anticipating an era of new settlement in Gaza. You know, expanding their territory was ultimately Netanyahu's plan all along. I mean, this is all documented, okay?
Right, right.
But the resistance was far greater and more clever than they anticipated. And now I'm wondering, has Iran's moves also had the effect of really shutting the door forever on their expansionist dreams? I mean, have they hemmed them into their existing territory?
Yeah, I don't see how Israel comes out of this. They're not coming out of it stronger. One, they're more isolated and ostracized in the world today than they've ever been in their entire history since their foundation. Their continued slaughter, murder of children in particular, and women is, it's really, it's a growing stain on what Israel's legacy is. And it's fueling anger throughout the world. But Israel has counted upon being able to inhabit these territories and be secure. And this, they think they can kill their way out of this, and that'll make them more secure, and they can't. You try to tell them that, they've enjoyed sort of what I call 75 years of fantasy, where they, you know, they revel in the rescue of hostages at Entebbe, which was, a miracle. And they think that that proves their military prowess. But then they turn around and they're the Zionists, what we're talking about, the ultra-Zionists in Israel are, they're stealing land. They're killing settlers, the Palestinians who've inhabited those lands for centuries. So it's just they are on a collision course with history is the best way I can define it.
Well, that brings up the question of the United States. You brought up the whole issue of pawns on the chessboard, and I'm bringing up that analogy. I'm wondering about in the case of the Middle East. I think Israel is essentially the U.S.'s queen, or at least a rook. And they're not going to just abandon it. I mean, at some point, won't they feel the need to actually get involved on the side of Israel, just to keep, to defend off Iran? And if so, then, if the U.S. has not joined Israel's side yet, but, it may eventually be inevitable for them to, protect their peace. How can Iran threaten the U.S.? What precise moves can it take to threaten them?
It can shut down oil coming out of the Persian Gulf. And the loss of that oil would put the United States in a severe economic bind. And Iran is quite capable of doing that. If you've just paid attention to the failure of the United States over the last 5 months to stop the Houthis from blocking the entrance into the Red Sea, if you go to the Straits of Hormuz, it's a much narrower area. So Iran could shut that down. It would be very damaging for the United States. Iran can't. Iran also could hit the U.S. military bases that are scattered around in Syria and in Jordan. Mm. So there's some things Iran could do. But the United States is already involved. We're involved militarily because they engaged some of the Iranian missiles coming in, or drones coming in the other day. They continue to supply Israel with munitions, artillery shells, cruise missiles, etc. So it is the only thing that's left is the United States trying to put its own troops on the ground to fight alongside the Israelis. I don't think that'll happen, but I can see the United States continue to provide assistance with air power and with sending the money.
Mm. Well, yeah, they can't just overthrow Iran like they overthrew Iraq, right? I mean, their own people are already fed up with wars. Your countrymen, I guess, would say, and right before the presidential election, people are already overwhelmingly fed up with Israel's antics. Yeah, but if Biden just stands up and weakly scolds Iran, that doesn't look very presidential either. So, you know, it could just make matters worse. And then there's Russia as an ally of Iran, and they have said that if they that they will step up if the United States gets involved. So, I mean, again, if they did involve, I mean, this would essentially destine the start of World War III, would it not?
Well, it certainly could lead to that. What mm-hmm. the Biden administration's playing a double game. Outwardly, they've shifted their public pronouncements to be more critical of Israel in order to try to pander to the Arab American and Muslim American community and those who support the Palestinian cause. Because up to this point, in almost every public appearance, Biden's being greeted with chants of "Genocide Joe, you got to go." And so he's, even though he's a demented guy and can barely remember what he had for breakfast in the morning, still, you know, he's still conscious enough that he can, that he finds that both irritating and it angers him. But look at what the United States is actually doing. Ignore what they say and that might be critical of Israel. The pipeline is open. They're sending the bombs. They're sending the money. They're sending their artillery. They're sending the artillery shells. So, you know, Israel can live with some public criticism from Biden just as long as the pipeline of goods is flowing to them.
Mm. Well, you know, how much longer does Israel have? And for that matter, how much longer does Netanyahu have? I mean, they're facing internal pressure from within their own circles.
I think a lot hinges up really upon what happens this week. The indication I have is that Israel is going to strike back at Iran. They're going to ignore the Iranian warning. They're not even just going to do something symbolic. If they hit with any kind of, you know, cause any kind of significant damage inside Iran, you're going to see the Iranians respond on a massive scale, which will then it will destroy a significant portion of Israel, and the Israelis will be outraged, and the United States will be further outraged against Iran. But then it gets to the question of what are we going to do? Mm. We don't have the United States does not have the military power to attack Iran. Yeah, we can send in some planes and blow some stuff up. How's that worked within Yemen? It has accomplished nothing. So if we dare to send any aircraft towards Iran, it's likely to get shot down. And then you're dealing with either dead pilots or captive pilots. So this really has the potential to make it spin out of control. Also important to understand that even if Israel gets rid of Netanyahu, Netanyahu's not the problem. It's the Zionist majority of Israel. If Netanyahu is dumped tomorrow, Israel's policy towards Gaza and the West Bank and all the Palestinians is not going to change. It's going to be as extreme as what they're doing right now. So it's, you know, getting rid of Netanyahu could be just that people don't like him. He's not as charming, perhaps, as Benny Gantz, but it's not going to change Israel's policy. That's what people need to understand.
So while there is still, how can the people of America, the people of Canada, what can we do now to help end this horror taking place in the Middle East and keeping it from widening further and impacting all of us ultimately too soon?
Impose an embargo on Israel. The United States needs to tell Israel, we're not sending you another bomb, we're not sending you another piece of artillery or cruise missile. You're done. You're cut off. And Canada should itself come out to call for a full arms embargo on Israel. It's only then that Israel get the message. and then recognize that its very survival is at stake. Because, you know, I think it's going to be very difficult to come up with a diplomatic solution to this. It's possible. It's not impossible, but it's not going to be easy either. But this wanton massacre of civilians has just got to stop. You know, the bodies of the children that are being stacked up. It's over 14,000-15,000 children. And you know what? the chutzpah on the part of Israelis the other day that one of the booster rockets on the ballistic missiles fell, and it's unclear how, but it severely wounded a Bedouin girl. That's how it was described. Oh, the outrage. Oh, my God, look at her. Iran has wounded a Bedouin girl. Meanwhile, Israel slaughters over 14,000 children, and the world just shrugs. So, okay, never mind, no big deal. At least the West does. So, again, the hypocrisy of the West on this is staggering.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for illuminating us on this situation, holding us all hostage. Looking forward to continuing this discussion with you really soon.
Okay, Michael. Thank you.
We've been speaking to Larry C. Johnson. He's a veteran of the CIA and the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. His website is sonar21.com.
Across Canada, many people have been mobilizing in their communities to ensure that they speak out and mobilize against the immoral and, in fact, genocidal policies employed by the settler state of Israel. Here are a few responses to what is happening in cities across the country.
Leadership in Israel seems to have no qualms about
As for the city of Winnipeg, every weekend there are demonstrations against Israel's atrocious violations of law and human dignity toward Palestinians. Tomorrow, Saturday the 20th at noon, the demonstration is on the south side of the Polo Park Shopping Center by the TD building. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.